So here we are at the last session of part one called Adjusting Your Expectations. So I'm hoping you are able to pinpoint some of the expectations you hold of yourself and of your kids. Page 17 gave you some of the common expectations held by many parents. And remember, it is these expectations that are what fuel our assumptions. So when we're kind of peeling away the layers, you are starting with your assumption, the assumption you're making of your child, and you're thinking, if I think that way of my child, what must I be expecting? Your goal, of course, is through all of this, through all of your parenting, is to be thoroughly in relationship with your child. There's absolutely nothing more important than that relationship. And that means being in the present, ugly and annoying as it may be. Our expectations take us out of the moment and put you smack into the past or into the future, depending on what it is you're focused on. So what I want you to become aware of is that often your expectations don't take into account who your child is, what his agenda is, or what he's capable of doing. Kids know long before we do how easy it is for our expectations to be set for the impossible. Usually we set them for much older kids than the kids we have, especially after siblings come along. We expect a four-year-old to act like an eight-year-old. And we expect that these kids are capable of doing just great, great things all the time. They certainly speak to what we want of our children and of ourselves, which is why we think they're good to have and why they're shoulds. You know, I should be doing this. My kids should be doing this. However, what we want and what we get, what we want of our children and what we actually get from our children are often very, very different, which means that what your children hear across the gap is that they can't ever be who you want them to be. When that happens, we can only see ourselves and our children as failures. And our children see themselves as failures if we don't budge from our expectations. So remember, you want to set your expectations for the child you have right now, not the child you wish you had, not the child you hope your child to be in 5 years or 10 years or 20 years, and also for who you are right now and not the parent you compare yourself to and come up short again and again. Of course you can aspire, of course you can wish for many wonderful things for your children, but when your assumptions and those unmet expectations take you into catastrophizing and imagining your children alone and friendless, unable to hold down a job because they won't listen to any rules, then no one wins. And in fact, you pull yourself and your kids down with your energy because you're feeling hopeless, you're feeling powerless, you're feeling like you're not doing a good job, and that energy just kind of makes everything a mess. What I'd like to do now, I hope we have a volunteer out here, I'd like to look at the complete the sentence exercise on page 19, determining my expectations. So whether you were able to zip right through that easily or whether you got stuck on it, I'd love to hear one, and we can talk it through, see how it goes. It's always helpful for other people on the call to hear what situations they have. All right, so Sabina, is this you?
Hello.
Hi.
Okay, so I'll give it a shot. I didn't find it like smooth sailing, but I'll give it a shot.
Okay.
Okay. Recently, when my child pushed my button by not wanting to have sunscreen applied to him, my assumption, fear, perception was that he is going to get a sunburn, skin cancer, and is this going to be an ongoing, is this going to be ongoing all summer every time sunscreen is put on him?
Mm-hmm.
What I expect my child to do, what I expect my child to do is to have the sunscreen applied calmly to him.
So for him to be calm and accepting of you applying the sunscreen, right?
Yeah, because it's like last year it was put on. It's almost like something that you have to do now.
Yeah.
He can't go outside unless he has sunscreen on. They put it on at daycare, et cetera. I don't even know how it is at daycare. I should ask how he is at daycare when they put it on the kids there. But it might be so quick.
We're talking about a 3.5-year-old,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, 3.5-year-old.
Yep.
So he could not be successful meeting this expectation because for some reason he does not like having sunscreen put on.
Mm-hmm.
My expectation, the expectation my child heard across the gap was, and I just used the same one from the example, you will do what I tell you to do when I tell you to do it always.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think he's thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I reacted by continuing to put the sunscreen on, telling him it will be over soon, which was not effective because he still did not enjoy it and continued to protest.
So you were expecting him to enjoy it?
Well, not so much enjoy it, but maybe just realize that this is something that just has to be done in order to go outside now.
Right.
So maybe enjoy is not the right word, but maybe like it's a necessity.
Right. So your expectation is that he should understand that it's a necessity.
Yes.
Okay.
I guess that's
sense?
Right. Yes, that's right. Yes. Yes, it is.
Yeah. Right.
That's my assumption, did you say?
That's your expectation.
Patient, my expectation.
Yeah. That he should, here's a should, there's usually a should, he should understand that it's a necessity.
Yeah.
Right.
So my child's agenda at the time was not to have the sunscreen applied. This applied. I think he still would not want it applied even if he was watching TV. I don't think it would be a big enough distraction. And I just made a note that I need to find out why. And my agenda was to apply this sunscreen and get out the door. If I had considered why the real reason he doesn't want it to be applied, my expectation might be adjusted to finding a way, and finding maybe another product or another way to make the process easier, better, and less traumatic. And then,
Now that's what you might have done.
Right? Yeah, if.
So first you want to adjust the expectation. So if your expectation is that he should understand that this process is a necessity now, then how would you adjust that expectation for your 3.5-year-old?
How would I adjust the expectation for him?
Right. So last time we talked about the of course mantra. So can you maybe use that here? Of course.
Of course he doesn't understand the importance of it.
Right. Right.
Yes, that's right. Now that I'm saying it. Like he doesn't realize, you're right. Yes, he doesn't realize the importance of the sunscreen.
No way he should realize it. 3.5. That is not part of who he is now, right? He's not going to realize the importance of it probably until he's in his 20s. Yeah. You know, he starts getting burned or something. I spent my young adulthood burning myself like crazy. So anyway, back to the situation. So yes, you see, if your expectation is that he should understand this, or my child should appreciate what I do for him, or he should listen to me when I'm talking to him. And then to get it really boiled down to my child and what my child is doing right now and what my child would much rather be doing than having me put sunscreen on him is, of course he doesn't want me to put sunscreen on him. Of course he doesn't understand the necessity of it. It's way beyond his scope. And then, as you said, if that had been the case, I would have responded by, go ahead.
I would have responded by, okay, if that had been the case, I would have responded by, hey, let's try this, another product, or how would you like to put your sunscreen on, or look at how mommy puts on her sunscreen.
Exactly. So getting him involved in it and acknowledging,
yeah,
maybe, that he doesn't like having sunscreen put on.
Yeah.
And then he might, you know, when he feels understood, when he's being considered, he might be more cooperative. He might not. At 3.5, you never know.
Yeah.
So does that make sense?
It does make sense. I hope it was a reasonable example.
All of them are. All of them are.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks. And Teresa, is this you?
Yes. Hi, Bonnie.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Do you want to run through yours?
Yeah, thank you. So I actually wasn't sure. Is it okay that I do mine? I forgot to unraise my hand, so...
No, yeah, that's fine. I wouldn't have called on you if not.
Okay. Okay. So recently when my child pushed my buttons, or my children pushed my buttons, by refusing to eat snack before bed, and then once I had read them, brushed their teeth, read them story, and put them to bed, they got up wanting to eat snack.
Mm-hmm.
So my assumption or my fear perception was that I was worried that by giving in, by letting them get up, I wasn't setting proper limits, and that they're going to be overtired tomorrow, and I'm going to have a horrible day. It's about me. And that they just aren't following the rules. And when I say that, I hear how ridiculous that sounds. It sounds silly.
That's what's so wonderful about doing these exercises. You know, you hear yourself, you write what you read what you've written, and it's sometimes, you know, that's kind of like, oh, I get it. Yeah,
I'm really, really starting to see that. So then what I expected my child to do or my children to do was to go to bed and to eat snack when I said to have snack.
Mm-hmm.
And
when you told them they were hungry.
Right. Yeah, and see, I thought I was being reasonable because they don't normally eat all their dinner, so I thought I was being reasonable by providing this. So, but anyhow, I expect them to eat the snack when I provide it and to fill their tummies and then, you know, to go to bed and not jump out of bed and try and leave the room when I say it's bedtime at the same time every day. And then they couldn't be successful in meeting that expectation because I think they just wanted to stay up and play because it's lighter out as the season is changing. And I think that's just what's happening is that they're wanting, they're their agenda is to just play longer and to be get up and then to eat. It's just all kind of wonky right now because of the time of year. The expectation that they heard from across the gap was that they must obey and that they have to obey mommy. Otherwise, mommy gets mad that they're bad, that they're a problem or a burden. Because I get frustrated, right? So I don't think they understand why I'm getting frustrated, really, because they're 2.5 and 4. So I react. I thought I was being reasonable again, give them extra time to eat snack. And I also let them get out of bed because I knew I couldn't physically control them. Like, it's not going to do anything. But when they didn't go to bed after a few minutes, because I tried to set a time, like not a timer, but to say, like, in this amount of time you can play, then we need to go to bed. And when they didn't do that, I said I was going to take the toys away that they were playing with, which I felt like I was grasping at straws, so which wasn't effective because punishment isn't motivating. But I just didn't know what to do because they weren't doing what I wanted them to do. And their agenda was to play and to eat when they wanted to eat. And my agenda was to get them to bed so that I could have my own quiet time and so that my day would go better tomorrow because I catastrophize and I worry because sleep is really important to me. If I considered all this, my expectations may have been adjusted to they – well, of course, they're 2.5 and 4. They're not going to want to eat when I say they need to eat and go to bed when I say they need to go to bed, especially when it's lighter outside and our whole daily habit has been changing because of the how beautiful it is outside. So if that had been the case, I would have responded by, and I actually don't really know what else I can do other than just relax and accept that their agenda is just their agenda. It's not to undermine me, or to they're not doing it. They're not doing it for the reasons that I think that they're doing it for. So I guess I would have responded by working harder to see their perspective. And then I just I don't know how to deal with it once I feel like I've been reasonable.
Right, I understand.
And they haven't obeyed. And I know it sounds crazy. They are not. I never thought I was that mother that would be like, you must obey. But the reality of it is I get really mad.
It would be very nice if they did.
Yeah.
Now, I just want to make this clear to everyone that understanding and this is. What Teresa was getting at here. Just because you understand what your child's agenda is, her kids didn't want to have snack when it was offered to them. They weren't hungry then. They wanted to play and then have snack later, all because they wanted to procrastinate going to bed. There are very few kids out there, I'm sure, who really want to go to bed. There are a handful of them, but not very many. So understanding the agenda does not mean that you give up your agenda and let them play as long as they want and give them snack whenever they want. I just want to make sure that everyone understands that. It's not about having no rules, having no regulations. It is you can still be very, very firm with your what you want to have happen with bedtime, for instance. The point is that when you understand, as Teresa was saying, when she got to that place, she realized they weren't doing it to get her. They weren't doing it to be mean or inconsiderate of her. It wasn't that they were unappreciative of her. It wasn't any of that. It was just that they wanted to play and eat when they wanted to eat. And, of course, that is normal. That is to be expected, right? So then when we can adjust those expectations and know that I expect that my kids are going to procrastinate going to bed. Then that just gets you into that head. You're already there when they're procrastinating, so you're not reacting in that place of thinking, oh, my God, they're never going to do this. They're not listening to me. They're not obeying me. And you get angry and overreact and exhaust yourself. So it's about just calming down and being able to be in the moment. And you can just sit there and think, well, of course they don't want to go to bed. It's light out. It's beautiful out. This is what's going on. And so it just kind of gets you in a little calmer place. And then you can actually connect with them. You guys don't want to go to bed. I know it. You want to play. You want to eat. It's not snack time now. We're not getting snack now. Would you rather have three more jumps on the bed or read one more book before we say goodnight? Something like that. So you go into a place where you are more open to seeing some possibilities. And the fact that you're not, you know, right away doesn't mean that that's not going to happen. So don't worry about that, Teresa. It will come. But as I said last week, I want you all to be really patient with yourselves with this process and really, you know, keep going over it in your mind. What is it? What's my assumption? My kids are not listening to me. They're not doing what I tell them. They're never going to listen to anyone. What is that coming from? What is the expectation I have that is fueling that assumption? Well, I expect them to listen to me and do what I say. And then, okay, let me look at the agendas. Let me look at what's going on. That is an unrealistic expectation of little kids. And then you kind of look at it that way and do the adjusting the expectation. Okay, thank you, Teresa.
Thanks, Bonnie.
Is this Annabelle?
Oh, yeah, hi.
Hi, Annabelle.
Hello.
Do you want to run through yours?
Yeah, it's a little bit similar around food. Is that okay?
Yeah, let's if you can just kind of go through it quickly, and then
okay.
I'll move on.
I'll do as quickly as I can.
Okay.
Recently, when my child pushed my button by getting up at 11 p.m., and making himself four jam sandwiches.
And now we're talking about a 13-year-old.
Nearly 13. Yeah.
Nearly 13, right.
And we've had a lot of stuff around bedtimes and lights out. Anyway,
yep.
my assumption, fear, perception was that it would actually wake him up more because it's jam sandwiches.
Right.
And he'll put on weight, which is a big fear of mine. And I know I'm kind of on top of this one.
Okay.
What I expected my child to do was to actually stay in bed and try and get to sleep. He could not be successful meeting this expectation because he couldn't get to sleep, and he tends to need to get up and make something to eat somehow. It's a way that he does to try and get him to sleep, right?
Mm-hmm.
Hello, I can't hear you.
I'm here. I'm hearing something else.
Yeah.
On the
okay.
line. But is it on your end?
No.
Okay.
It's not on my end.
Okay,
shall I keep going?
Go ahead. I think I still had Teresa unmuted, so go ahead.
Okay. The expectation my child heard across the gap was, you should get that eating late is bad for you, and it actually won't help you sleep.
Right.
Especially jam sandwiches. And I reacted when I saw that he'd made four jam sandwiches. I reacted by exclaiming, "What are you doing up? That won't help you sleep." And I took three of them away and left him with one, which was not effective because he felt kind of upset. He got upset. Okay. So my child's agenda at the time was to get up and eat to help him sleep.
Mm-hmm.
He thought that would help him sleep. And my agenda was to have him get to sleep as soon as possible so that I could also get to sleep, as I'm often very tired. And I'm afraid I catastrophize around him being really tired at school, which he often is. And if I'd considered all of this, my expectation might adjust to, of course he wants to eat to help himself sleep. He's quite desperate. He really, really wants to get to sleep. And I sometimes eat to get to sleep as well.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if I wake up in the middle of the night, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so if that had been the case, I would have responded by just understanding more his point of view, that he's quite desperate to get to sleep and he thinks that eating will help. And actually it's his body. And getting that actually he doesn't do it all the time. It doesn't happen every night. So to stop
mm-hmm.
panicking around,
mm-hmm.
you know, the catastrophizing around, oh my God, he's eating again.
Right.
And I also thought that I could respond by actually talking about some healthy snacks he could have instead of jam sandwiches. Maybe there's something else he could eat instead that would help him sleep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Does that sound all right?
Milk. That's great. And,
yeah.
You know, to even just start off by saying, huh, having a hard time getting to sleep, are you?
Mm.
You know,
yeah.
Which is just that little connecting piece.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Just a piece of information
mm.
about teenagers, and I don't know at exactly what age it starts, but the teenage circadian rhythm is very, very different from younger children and older adults.
Mm.
Their melatonin is not released until way several hours later than I'll say preteen or young adult.
Mm-hmm.
The melatonin which is what helps us fall
yeah.
asleep,
yeah.
isn't released until late, and it stays releasing well into the morning.
Yeah,
so
no, I'm aware of this.
We're expecting,
yeah.
yeah, we're expecting teenagers to be, you know, alert and ready and able to do their math at 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning. You know, and it's
mm.
ridiculous. They should be sleeping.
Yeah,
right.
I know, but
wanted
what
to
do because the system, you know.
Right, exactly. But what to do is to understand that he's having
yeah.
a hard time going to sleep.
Yeah, yeah, no, I get that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Thanks, Bonnie.
All right. And, Nicole, did you have a question?
Nope, no question.
Okay. Sheila, do you have a question?
I wanted to do read my thing, but I think you're moving on.
Well, let's go for it. And
okay, I'll go fast.
Yeah, well.
Okay.
Whatever. Okay.
Recently, when my child pushed my button by getting out of his car seat, he's a 4-year-old twin, my assumption, fear, perception was that it's dangerous to do this and he should stay in his car seat. What I expected my child to not do was stay in his car seat and get back in it immediately when I asked him to. He could not be successful meeting this expectation because it was fun for him to be out of his car seat, and he was looking for a toy that fell.
Ah. Mm-hmm.
The expectation my child heard across the gap was, I never let him have his way. And I wrote, and it's not such a big deal to get out of his car seat. That was what he's thinking, right?
Yeah.
What's a big deal? So I reacted by, you know, yelling and threatening and, you know, get back in your seat, da-da-da, like that. Mm-hmm. And that was not effective because he still took a long time to get back in. His agenda at the time was to get his toy, and my agenda was to have him get in his car seat.
And what else? Were you in a hurry? Were you?
Well, we were driving.
You were driving and... Right, and so,
you were...
I just wanted him to get back in as soon as possible.
Right. Were you in a hurry to where you were going?
Probably.
Aren't we always?
Yeah.
Right.
Or we were just coming back. I kind of reversed my answers. So I have to, when I considered all of this, my expectation might adjust to pull over and wait for him to get the toy or tell him to get in his seat and that I would pull over as soon as I could. And
right.
then he could get
and that's the toy. And that's what I think you would want to have down at the bottom. That's how you would have responded had
right.
you adjusted your expectation. Right. So
right.
How,
that's,
yeah.
And then so that what was where my little arrow, I put, let's see. If I had considered all of this, my expectation might adjust to let him have the toy as soon as possible.
Well, your expectation is what you expect of this behavior. So, but you're there. I mean, you've got it. It would be like, and of course, he just wants to get his toy. He's too young to realize that it's dangerous to get out of his car. Right.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
It's very interesting. It's a great. It's really great. It's a great exercise because it's just like what I want, to get in your car seat, but it doesn't work.
Yeah, it's a good one about the agendas, isn't it? Because that is so important to you. Of course, it should be so important to you. And why does he care about it? He doesn't want to be in his car seat. It's much more fun to be out. Yeah, that's great.
Thank you.
Okay. So, again, you want to be sure that you're setting your expectations for the child you have. And we saw in those exercises that the original expectations, the ones that cause problems, are often ones that are set for older children, expecting them to understand certain things that a child wouldn't, or that, you know, that we know better for them than they know for themselves when they're definitely old enough to know more about themselves. I'm wondering if anyone has, if the questions on page 21, was there anything? It's basically another way of doing the same thing. So I think since we did several of those complete the sentences, I'll move on. If any of you are stuck with the expectation, please raise your hand and we'll talk about that, because sometimes it's not clear what I'm expecting. What's wrong with what I'm expecting? Or shouldn't I have these expectations for my kids? Or doesn't this mean if I adjust it, doesn't this mean I'm letting my kids get away with anything? If you think any of those things, please raise your hand, and you, I'm sure, will be answering questions for more people. Yes, Nicole. Nicole?
Hi, Bonnie.
Hi.
Yes. Hi. My situation that I went through for expectations was for my 9-year-old. And I guess my question about the expectation is, what do you do when I realized what she was going through and I started with empathy? And granted, I certainly didn't try it for long enough because I got a button pushed and I didn't control myself. But what do you do when the empathy doesn't work? Does that mean missing what they're really feeling, or that is
not necessarily. I actually wanted to talk about that a little later. So I think what I'll do is use this opportunity and your question to bring it up now. A common expectation I hear from parents is that if I say the right thing, and in your case, if I empathize with my child, then my child should cooperate and do as I ask. The behavior should change. They should understand. Right? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, even though I know I'm wrong, but yes.
Well, but that's what we do. It's very natural. And so there is another expectation. You hear the should. If I say the right thing, my child should behave differently. My child should understand. My child should appreciate what I'm doing, blah, blah, blah. So the expectation piles on, and it becomes another manipulation. So let me say this. All the things that we are working on in terms of how you present yourself as a parent to your children, how you get yourself to that place of a little more calm, a little more neutral, a little more disengaged from the problem so that you can be more objective and less judgmental, all of this is so that you will be the model for who you want your children to become. If you empathize with your children, they will learn empathy. If you respect your children, they will learn respect. We can't teach these things if we're not modeling them. So if I am going to be considerate of what my child is going through, then eventually my child is going to be considerate of me, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if I expect that right now, if I say the right thing, if I'm nice, if I'm not blowing up and I'm not yelling, but if I say the right thing, then my child should understand. And if I think that way, then I'm being just as manipulative as if I were using a punishment to get what I want. Do you see what I mean?
Yes, and so, I think that just listening to you explain that, I realize that it's also one of my buttons because it's something I didn't get as a child. I definitely got the message that you're not allowed to have feelings or even bad feelings, so it's probably why it's one of my triggers, I guess.
Of course. So just to kind of put that all in perspective, what you're doing is working on yourself. What you're doing is being the kind of person you want your child to be. So if you're empathizing with your child, now say again, Nicole, when you empathized, what happened?
She just continued to resist and to yell about what she didn't want to do. I was asking her to come and eat breakfast to get ready for school.
Uh-huh.
And,
she
took a bagel I'd made her and threw it and said, I don't want this stupid bagel. You know, she just was acting out immediately like she just didn't want to be doing what I was asking her to do and just letting me know.
And how did you empathize?
I said, I can see maybe you're not hungry yet. You haven't had a lot of time this morning because you got up a little bit late and she just kept back at me with the attitude and not saying, she at no point did she melt and feel like, yeah, Mom, you get me. You know, it was more kept putting it back.
She had more to unload.
You were
in our empathizing, we can't understand completely what's going on with our child. You know, she might have been worried about what was going to happen when she got to school because some kid called her a funny name yesterday. You don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know what it's about. So you can't pinpoint what to empathize around unless you know specifically. You are so mad because I asked you to turn off the television and come to dinner. That is not what you want to do. Okay? You can be pretty sure that that's what's going on, because you're right there, and you know what provoked the anger. So all you can do is kind of go with that. And if you don't get it, if you don't hit the nail on the head with it, then just kind of pull back and listen. You know, let her unload. And don't take it personally. That's the key. When you can know that she's just got to unload. And if you're getting attitude, if you're getting rude words, if you're getting stuff that is not okay, this is not the time to say, don't you talk to me like that. I'm not making you blah, 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 to what happened this morning. And wonder if you could tell me what was going on that caused you to speak to me in that way, because I know that's not how you usually speak to me, and you know that I don't like to be spoken to like that, so I'd really like to know what was going on. That's when you're both past it, you're out of it, so you can get back to it and you can talk about it objectively, and that's probably when she's going to say, yeah, I'm sorry, Mom, I was just blah, blah, blah. Or she might say, I don't want to talk about it. And, if she says something like, I don't want to talk about it, then maybe you say, that's fair. I just want you to know that didn't feel good to me this morning. And I know whatever was going on with you didn't feel good either, but it felt like you were taking that out on me, and that didn't feel fair. That is all the stuff you can say when it's past, you see? In the moment, just let her unload and don't take it personally.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yep.
Similar to that, Melanie in Toronto had said that she found that it only annoys her 4-year-old to make assumptions about her feelings, in other words, empathize in that way, in order to validate them. She said that her daughter seems insulted if she assumes a feeling incorrectly. Now, that is a case in point that you are not putting words in your children's mouths by empathizing with them, by validating what you are assuming they're feeling. They will tell you if you're wrong. So I think probably if this happens enough, Melanie, I think what you want to do is take the message that your daughter just wants you to listen. So sometimes empathizing means saying nothing, but standing there with the body language that I'm here for you, I get it. You need to unload. You need to get this out. I'm not going to take it personally. I'm your sounding board. You can dump it. And what you don't want is your child to get into that habit of blaming you and giving you the responsibility for their problems. And that's what you can talk about later after the emotions come down. And we're going to talk a little more about problems, who owns the problem, in a little bit. First, I just want to say that, acknowledge some of you, like Teresa in Ontario, Dana in Georgia, hold an expectation similar to, my children shouldn't fight with each other. I should be able to stop it and make them get along. And because of that expectation, you spend a lot of energy stuck in your head and focused on how bad things are and feelings of frustration and not knowing what to do. Right? So that's what happens when we get into these expectations and let our assumptions get the better of us. So in a situation like that, for instance, the assumption might be my children are violent and hate each other. or they're never going to be friends, or they're never going to learn to get along with anybody if they can't get along with each other, right? And I'm a failure as a parent. These are the catastrophizing assumptions. I'm a failure as a parent for not having taught them to love each other and to get along and to be kind to each other. So when we get into moments like that, we completely forget the moments that they do get along. Even if they're few and far between, those are the moments you want to really focus on. When you focus on those moments, they're going to grow. Whatever moments you focus on are going to grow. So take more of your focus away from the bad situations and put them on the good situations. Okay, so that assumption, you know, my children are never going to get along. They're always going to have a problem with relationships, blah, blah, blah. A reframed assumption might be, my kids have a hard time sharing things. My kids sometimes really don't like each other. And sometimes they do. You see, that's, it's just more objective, it's more realistic. And the expectation, my children shouldn't fight, they should get along, they should be kind to each other. The adjusted expectation would be, I expect my kids to fight and have struggles with each other. And I can say that clearly for any of you who have more than one child. Your siblings are going to fight. Some fight way more than others, but it is the nature, well, I shouldn't say the nature of siblings, because it didn't happen so much in indigenous tribal cultures. There were not the same kind of pressures that we put on our kids. But siblings fight. Siblings learn about relationships with other people through fighting with each other. That doesn't mean they're going to go out and fight with their friends because they fight with each other. Think about yourself and your relationship with your siblings. It's a different kind of a ball game, and I know some of you have twins, and man, there's another ball game altogether. Twins just have a language all to themselves. Okay, so these are the, we've done the assumption, the reframed assumption, the expectation, the adjusted expectation. With an adjusted expectation, a new response might be, I bet you kids can find a way to work this out. Do you need help doing that? The more you give them trust that they're able to work it out, and the more time you give them to work it out, you're going to find that it happens more often. And then there's also conflict resolution to talk about. There's a lot going on with conflict resolution, which is a skill that I think we all need to have. When our kids fight and they can't work it out, we can then facilitate them talking to each other about what they're mad about, not tell them what to do about it, not send them to their rooms, not take away privileges if they can't get along. We need to know that it is not our job to fix their problems, but we can help them fix their problems. So then when we do try to fix it, by telling them what they should do or should not do, or just ignore her. If you just ignore her, you're not going to give her what she wants, and she'll just leave you alone. That's projecting ourselves as grown-ups into the situation. It's not helpful to your kids. So it's letting them come up with the solutions. Instead, expect that your kids are going to fight, and that most of the time they can work it out. Even if they do it in ways you don't like, let them. Sometimes you need to connect with what's going on beneath the iceberg at a time separate from the fighting. So that's, you know, if you know that, well, for instance, I had a question from Judy in Arizona who said that she had used the iceberg to see that beneath the arguments her 13-year-old has with her younger sister are feelings of powerlessness. So she did the iceberg. She saw that powerlessness was in there. They've moved to a new school, and the 13-year-old doesn't feel as successful as she did at the old school. But she sees her sister having a much easier time adapting. So, of course, there's, and this is a younger sister as well. So, Judy, simply seeing this puts you in a place of compassion, right? When you think that the 13-year-old is being mean to her sister and you've got to stop her being so mean, that just gets you into anger and controlling behavior and all of that. But when you see that she's feeling powerless and in relation to her younger sister who's doing better, having a much easier time, then you just move effortlessly into compassion. Either let them work out their fights or help facilitate. You want this, you want that. How can you make it work so both of you get what you want? And then sometime when you're alone with your 13-year-old, I think it's really important to acknowledge that it must be really hard for her when you see certain issues happening for her, that this she's not loving the new school as much as her sister is, and that's got to be really hard for her to watch her sister kind of slide through the process. I used to do that with my daughter, whose older brother had just the easiest time everywhere he went. Tons of friends, easy in school, good in sports, everything. And she really struggled with just about everything. And it was really helpful to her when I was able to acknowledge that it had to be really hard to watch her brother just kind of slide through life and have all these, you know, situations that were easy. Without the buts, you know, don't, you're so tempted to add on the but because you just want them to feel so much better. But try not to go with the butt. Just stick your foot in the water of it's got to be hard when you see your younger sister having an easy time. See what happens. See where that goes. That might just open the floodgates, you know. Now, what's your problem? This is boundaries. This is about boundaries. And I use boundaries as something that is more emotional, more psychic, more intangible. I don't use boundaries and limits in the same way. Many people do. I just want to explain that. A boundary is the space, is what's between me and you. When we all know what it feels like when someone kind of enters our personal space, that's like they're invading a boundary. They're going over a boundary, right? That's the kind of boundary I'm talking about, although not physical necessarily. In relation to expectations, the expectations you hold of your children are your problem. On your side of the boundary, I have, all right, on my side of the boundary, I have my problems, my issues, my feelings, my agendas, my hopes and dreams. All of that is mine. And if I have good boundaries with my child, I do not ask my child to take care of my problems or be responsible for my feelings. When I get angry at my child, you make me so mad. I'm telling my child, you're responsible for my emotions. That means your boundary is off. So it's very important for you to own that. I am angry. That's okay. Nothing wrong with you being angry. You have as much right to your feelings as your child does. Just own it. So that's me on my side of the boundary. My child, on her side of the boundary, has her problems, her issues, her feelings, her hopes and dreams, her wishes, her agenda. Right? What happens when we cross the boundary is that we start taking responsibility for our children's emotions, for our children's happiness, for our children's responsibilities. We fix things for them. We want them so much to be happy. We don't know how to handle their emotions because nobody was good at handling our emotions. If that's what the case was, if no one honored your emotions and could label them, could name them, could talk about how awful it feels when something disappointing happens without, you know, fixing it, but not just acknowledging it. If nobody did that for us, it makes it hard for us to do for someone else. What's important to realize is that you don't have to fix it. You don't have to take responsibility for what's your child's, right? If I have an expectation that my child should listen and do what I say, expecting my child to listen and do what I say and the resulting frustration of that is my problem, right? That's mine. If I own it, I'll have a much easier time of gaining cooperation. If I get mad at my child for not listening, for not doing what I want when I want it, I'm asking her to take care of my problem. Do you see that? I get really frustrated when I think that no one is listening to me will get more attention from your child than why don't you ever listen. You see, it's not a huge change in linguistics, but it is a huge change in the meaning, in the perception, in the expectation. I get really frustrated when I think that no one is listening to me. I'm owning my problem with it, right? When I say, why won't you ever listen to me? Why don't you do what I say? You've got to do this. All the things that we expect of our child, it comes across as blame. And when our child feels blamed, they feel defensive. And what we need to realize is that when they feel defensive, they're going to behave defensively. And we've got to understand that their choice of defensive behavior, whether it's telling us that they hate us, whether it's blocking their ears and running away, whether it's laughing, whether it's saying, I don't care, those are defensive reactions to something they're hearing from us that they don't like. And what they hear from us that they don't like are typically our automatics, those automatic reactions, those knee-jerk reactions that happen when we get a button pushed, when we feel out of control, when we are reminded that we're not whatever the button is about. We're not smart enough. We're not good enough. We're not capable enough of getting our children to do what we want. You use those automatic reactions, which become addictive, by the way. You use them to get your children to solve your problems, to make you feel better, to be less angry, to be more like a good parent. So there are just so many layers to all this. And I don't expect you to, you know, get all of it, right, all in one fell swoop. But I do think that if you do go through this process and use these complete the sentence exercises again and again, you're going to come up with different things as you go along. So any questions on that? Any questions on boundaries? I'm wondering if there is someone out there who would, this is skipping ahead in the, because this is the last class of part one. So, all right, here I have a question. Yes, Annabelle.
Yeah, my question is, if we're saying it right, as you're saying, and owning in a more empathic and owning way,
right,
if our child still gets defensive and says, I hate you, go away, leave me alone, I mean, cause
mm-hmm.
can that happen?
Yes, absolutely that can happen. And that's, and it goes back to what I was saying before, that you're doing this for you because you want to model a responsible person with good boundaries, right?
Mm.
You're not expecting your child to suddenly become a mini you.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're going to get. And your child might be in, you know, this is a new reaction. What are you doing? You're not, you know, this is odd. Even if it helps them feel better, even if they feel a little more understood, like you're listening, if you're suddenly different, they don't necessarily like it.
And even if you're owning your stuff and saying it in a more empathic way and blah, 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 they still might not like what you're asking them to do.
Exactly.
And so they're still going to react if you're setting a limit. Yeah.
Right, and or the tantrum is still going to happen, or resistance is still going to happen. That's okay.
So we're not getting it wrong, then. Okay.
No.
Yeah. Okay.
Not about right and wrong.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So I'm wondering if anyone would be willing, if you haven't done it already, which was not part of your homework, but since it is the end of part one, the exercise on page 24, the complete the sentence exercise, did anyone do that? Nicole?
Yes.
Did you do that? The adjusting my expectations?
Yes.
Great. Do you want to run through that?
Sure. The beginning part has to do a little bit with what I talked to you about earlier, but I'll just quickly run through it anyway, the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
When my child pushes my button by yelling or losing her temper because she doesn't want to do something I've asked her to do, what I expect of my child is to have learned by now how to go through our, how to eat, get dressed, and get washed, and go through our routines. And what I expect of myself is that I should have taught them this by now. What I experienced as a child in this area was to do what I told, or I got screamed at, and I was mostly just left to do things on my own.
Mm-hmm.
Because my mother and father were separated, and when they were together, they were fighting. I was number 13, and by that time, my mother had had enough and had a lot of stresses because my father, throughout my childhood, was trying to take our house away and was not giving her any financial help. The message I got on the other side of the gap is you are a nuisance, nobody cares what you do, and you're a nuisance when you want for anything. This negatively affects my parenting today because my first instinct is to yell when I'm not getting my way.
Right.
I still feel unworthy because I feel like when I'm they're not listening, I'm doing a bad job as a parent. My expectation can take...
Just as you did a bad job as a child. It just takes you right back to that place.
Yep.
Yeah.
My expectation can change when I understand that there are so many great things I do with my daughters, and all along I've done the best that I know how at the time, and that I'm always willing to keep learning and trying to do better.
That's great. You definitely got it. It's really hard when we realize that when that button gets triggered, what's happening is it reminds us of that time when we felt unloved, unappreciated, unaccepted, a nuisance, a problem. And children can say things to us or do things that just trigger that old place. And if you all are going to continue on with part two, we look clearly into why that happens and what we can do about it. Not that there's any magic cure here, but if we're willing to dip into this, it just raises our consciousness a little more. I don't know whether I said this earlier in the course, but what I consider this whole course to be about is raising our consciousness as if we were raising a dimmer switch. It's not an on-off. I'm either suddenly I'm a great parent after I've been a terrible parent. It's not that at all. It's I'm getting more and more conscious of what is going on in my life, what makes up my story. You're not going to erase it. You're not going to make it go away. You're going to then incorporate it. So what you said, Nicole, in your how your expectation can change is beautiful. That's what you want to put more focus on. It doesn't mean the pain of what was triggered isn't there, but you're going to take more notice of it. You're going to be more aware of what it is that gets triggered, and the more awareness you put to it, the less painful it becomes. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the things that is very important to understand is that the value we perceive our parents placed on us, perceive being the operative word, right? You perceived that your parents thought of you as a nuisance.
Mm-hmm.
The value we perceive our parents place on us is the value we place on ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we'll look much more closely at that in part two. And that's why the tears come. That's why the trigger is there. That's, you know, that's still very...
Yeah, I was...
And it's good. That's healing, you know. I believe that's very healing to let yourself go there. Okay, got a couple more raised hands here. Is this Alana?
Yes.
Hi.
Hi. So, you know, on page 25, what to do when my buttons gets pushed, the first one, stop, don't react, walk away. So there have been times when I just try to walk away, and my five-year-old just refuses to let me calm down, and he follows me, and I close my door, and he's banging on my door and kicking
yes.
it, and,
yes.
which just gets me more fired up.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Do in a
this
situation.
Is great. I'm so glad you're asking this because this is exactly what I wanted to move into now was that handout, that the 9 habits of diffusing your buttons. And so what you're talking about is what happens when you walk away.
Mm-hmm.
And in that instance, what this is your five-year-old, right?
Correct.
when your kids know that you're upset and then you walk away, they're going to do exactly what your five-year-old is doing. Right? It's like it becomes another appendage. He follows you. He pounds on the door, all of that stuff. Do you know why that is, Alana?
I think he's wanting it or needing attention.
And what's your when you're triggered, when your button is pushed, what's the assumption you make when he does that?
Gosh, there's so many. What assumption do I make?
Yeah,
it's not easy. It's not he's out to get me. It's here we go again. Why does he keep doing this?
Yeah. And so that leads you to feel how?
Very frustrated. Yeah, just very frustrated.
Yeah. And how do you typically react?
Typically, I yell. I yell and scream.
Okay.
So, I guess what happens is I react and then I walk away. I just realized.
There you go. The reason he follows you is because he knows you're upset, especially if you've already reacted.
Yes.
And he's following you because he's got to know that you are going to get back in control. One of the assumptions that parents make is that He's not even going to let me have time by myself. He's just got to win. He's got to be on top of me. He's got to control me. He's got to do everything.
Yeah.
In fact, what's happening is he's scared, and he needs to know that you're okay, that you're in control. And when you're upset and when you're reacting, you're not in control.
Right.
So that's scary for him. Even when it seems like a child is, we think all he wants to do is control me and run the whole family. He's running the whole family. It's usually exactly the opposite, right? He's desperate for you to be in control. So in order for that walking away bit to be successful, this is really hard, and this is kind of advanced buttons work. You need to get away before your child is clued in to your upset.
Gotcha.
So what we're going to do, I'm going to put you back on mute, Alana, and I'm going to go through these 9 steps here. And but anyone who has a question about any of this, do raise your hand. That was a great lead-in, because what's important to do is to become aware. The first step is to become aware of what happens to you physically. And when I ask parents this, what do you feel? What happens in your body? I get all kinds of things, like my throat tightens, my stomach clenches, I feel it in my chest, my hands start to tingle, my head hurts. I had a father once say, my ears get red and hot. There are all of these kinds of things that physically happen to us. Now, and I do say this is advanced buttons work, if you can recognize that physical reaction and walk away, go to the bathroom, tell your child you've got to go to the bathroom, you'll be right back. If you can get away before your child knows you're upset, great. If not, you'll probably have the situation that Alana has where your child is after you. In order to be able to do that, feel what you're feeling, recognize, a button's getting pushed, I'm going to walk away. You've got to be in that place of knowing that nothing I say or do right now is going to be effective. Remember, the most effective, the most you're going to do effective is not at all effective. Right? It's going to range from, your reaction is going to range from not at all effective to damaging. So when your button has been pushed, do not react. Hard to do. Much easier to say than do. Believe me, I know this. So, you know, give yourself some compassion when you react, when you don't mean to. It takes a while, but I really do encourage you to stay with this process of going over it in your mind afterwards, thinking about your assumption, thinking about your feelings, where this all comes from, blah, blah, blah. Okay. If you can get away, great. If you can't get away, you're right there. What you need to do is breathe. And I cannot underscore this more. In absolutely every program you will ever hear about, you will ever know about, anyone will ever tell you, breathing is critical to getting yourself grounded, to bringing your emotions, the storms that are going on in your head, to bringing them back to neutral. And a breath includes an inhale and an exhale. What we typically do is inhale and hold our breath, especially when you're yelling and screaming. I mean, think about it. You start yelling and screaming and you're not breathing. It's just, you're just holding your breath and you're getting angrier and angrier and angrier. So breathe and practice this. If you can learn to meditate and do that every day, it could change your life. Breathe, inhale and exhale three times at least. And if you do that, you can teach your child to do that too. Okay, it's time to breathe right now. And then do it. And let your child know that you're breathing. Inhale and exhale at least three times. And it will help you cool down. If you can wait until all your emotions are down, much better. And then again, like we had said before, note the feelings that come up for you. This is number three. When your button gets pushed, be specific. And remember, anger always covers up fear. I get angry because I'm afraid that, dot, dot, dot. Many feelings fall under anger. So don't just stay with frustrated, angry, mad. See if you can break them down into being more specific. And again, I think it's easiest to start with your emotions, to write that down, because it's easier to identify. Then, four, ask yourself, what must I have been thinking to feel that way? What was my thought? Because you now know from the emotional chain reaction that feeling, those feelings, any feelings you come up with, are always provoked by a thought, by a perception, by a judgment, by an assumption. They're all the same thing. What must I have been thinking to feel the way I did? And then make note of these thoughts and write several until it's like a boing. And again, whether you think they're justified or not, these are assumptions that provoke your emotions, and that's where your reactions come from. 5 is don't take it personally. Obviously, this is so much easier said than done. You can't see the situation objectively or respond effectively when you take it on. And taking it personally means that boundary has been crossed and you are taking your child's emotions or reactions or behavior on as your problem. That's what that means. If I take it personally and I react, it means I will only feel good, I will only feel competent, I will only feel authoritative if my child is calm, cool, collected, happy, whatever. So if my child is disappointed, if my child is frustrated, if my child is jealous, and I take it on as my fault or my responsibility, that means I'm taking it personally. So think about that boundary. You can always come back to a situation when your emotions are calm. Try not to react as Alana did before she walks away and breathes and detaches, right? So you can come back to the situation hours, days, weeks later, even years. 6 is detach. When you're able to not take it personally, when you're able to allow your child to take responsibility for her own emotions, for her own problems, for her feelings, it doesn't mean you're going to be cold and unfeeling and neglectful. It doesn't mean you're washing your hands of it and saying, sorry, kid, this is your problem, I'm out of here. It means you're allowing your child to have this problem, which is allowing your child the richness of life. Then when you can do that, you can detach enough to realize this is not about you, so then a lot of your assumptions go away. And it's about your child having a problem rather than being a problem, so that you can be more neutral, you can be more objective, and when you can do that, you can be much more of a help to your child. You see, when I have my problem on my side of the boundary and my child has his problem on his side of the boundary, that doesn't mean we are living these separate parallel paths and never the twain shall meet. It means when I own my problem and I allow my child to own his problem, that means that I can offer help to my child. I can say, would you like, this is what I see is going on with you. Would you like my help? Would you like my advice? Would you like to talk about it? So I can be much more helpful to my child when I step out of the pain, right? When my daughter was little, she had a lot of pain over a lot of things that were very obvious that I had no control over. And I just felt so awful that I couldn't make it go away, that I couldn't make her understand certain things that would help her feel better about it, that I couldn't reason with her and blah, blah, blah. And so one time I asked her if she, because I tried everything in my bag of tricks, and she was still having a lot of fear over nightmares. She was having a lot of problems. And she went and talked to a friend of mine who was a therapist, which she was very eager to do. But I first had a session with the therapist, and I was explaining to her what was going on with Molly, and as I was sitting there, tears were streaming down my face as I was telling her about all the stuff that Molly was dealing with, and the therapist said to me, you can be so much more help to her when you don't get in her pain with her. And it was like this giant light bulb went off in my head. I got it immediately. And I've been teaching it to parents ever since. It is such a relief when you can understand that your child's journey is your child's. You cannot presume to be powerful enough to either make your child happy or make your child unhappy. Or whatever is going on in your child's life, it is her path, her journey. And when I got into Molly's pain with her, which meant that I was trying so hard to make her understand certain things, I was just making it worse. And when she knew that I was upset, then she had me to worry about as much as well as herself. So when I stepped out of her pain, I was then able to hold her, both figuratively and literally. I could help her. I could support her. I could help her feel understood, loved, and accepted no matter what was going on for her. So that's a biggie, that detachment. 7 is witness. Watch yourself. Develop that little witness voice that watches. Don't you sometimes have that little bubble that forms over your head when you're reacting to your child and screaming, and that voice is saying, why are you saying that? You know that's not going to work. It's, you know, listen to that. That's your witness. And with detachment, you can, you'll get more creative. You'll be able to do problem solving. You'll be able to take on all the other skills. Now, 8. Use affirmative self-talk. This is one that you kind of you have to tailor for yourself. We all know how easily we talk to ourselves about, you know, what a lousy parent we are, and how can you let this happen, and what is wrong with you, and why can't you, and you're this, and you're that, and all these assumptions and expectations we put on ourselves that just take us down. The energy just drains out of us when we have all this stuff going on in our head that is so negative. So what I'm talking about is going to the affirmative. I'm not talking about positive this and my child is wonderful and I'm a perfectly great parent and everything's going to be rosy and everything's going to be fine. And I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about getting down to the nitty-gritty, getting to the specifics of what is really happening. So moving from judgment into objectivity. So go over that situation in your head. Remind yourself of, you might say, oh, boy, there goes that control button again. Look at that. I just went immediately zoom into that. Or here you go again, Bonnie. You're asking your child to be appreciative of everything you've done. So you're just kind of becoming aware, right? It's increasing the awareness. Here's that old feeling of feeling put down by my child because I felt put down when I was little. Here's that. It's so familiar, that place that I go to. And it's okay. As you empathize with your child, empathize with yourself. It's okay. And it's the of course mantra for yourself. Of course you're going to go into this. Of course when she says that, you're going to get triggered. That's okay. You're still working on this. So it's having that compassion for yourself, which comes up more in part 2. And, you know, if you can go through all of these steps of looking at your assumptions and your agendas and all of that, and then 9, adjusting your expectations to one your child can meet successfully, And then at the back of your workbook, you have what I call the refrigerator box, which just, you know, plaster up somewhere to kind of remind yourself in a little fewer, bolder steps. But then you have this diffusing your buttons worksheet, and there are places for three different situations so that you can go through it and look at the behavior, the emotion, the reaction, blah, 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 all the changes that you do. So use that for yourself to work through situations. And, you know, either make copies of it or do them in pencil or something so you can do them again and again. So our time is up. Our part one is over. I have sent you all the link for the registration for part two. If you have not gotten that and are interested in continuing on with part two, please email me and let me know you don't have that link or you lost it or whatever. In part two, we get more to the hard stuff, where we find out where our buttons got started. The messages we took in on the other side of the gap get taken into our child minds. These are little children who believed what we believed based on our parents' reactions to us. And they become, in our minds, the truth with a capital T. You know, like Nicole thinking she was just a nuisance. That is what she believed to be the truth. It still drives her today and gets triggered when her children react in certain ways. Then we look at why we keep hanging on to those beliefs. We look at what goes on in our brain that makes those beliefs real, and why we hang on to them is because they actually serve us in some way. And when we can really look at that, then some movement really starts to happen. And it becomes easier to let go. The buttons are probably always going to be there, but they're not going to be quite so charged. They're not going to get triggered quite so easily. It's not that suddenly you're not going to have these buttons anymore. We are who we are. But you can very, very, I won't say easily, with work, you can definitely defuse them. With that said, those of you who already know you're going on with part two and have been able to download the workbook pages, just plug on a little further and see if you can do some of the next bits. And does anyone want to say anything before we sign off? This has been, you know, a really nice experience for me. I hope you've been getting something out of this, and I would really love it if you could write me an email and let me know how this has worked for you. Maybe what I'll do is write down some questions and send them to you. But I'd really like to know how this worked for you and what might make it better for another one of these in the future. So with all of that, I will say goodbye, and I hope to see you all in part two. Teresa, you had a question. Or a comment.
Yeah, I just wanted to let you know, Bonnie, that there were a few things about this course that just were like a light bulb moment for me. Mm-hmm. One of them was, which I'm sure was true for everybody, was realizing that our children not only have an agenda, but and I know you'd mentioned that in the beginning, but that really was big for me.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. And a few more things, just on more practical side with how to deal with being in that sort of in-between space of sort of you sort of have that narrative in your mind, oh, why am I doing this again? But you're still being triggered.
Mm-hmm.
But hearing, being validated, and hearing that it's okay, that it is a process,
mm-hmm.
for me personally, is also very huge. Self-acceptance, and I know you're going more into that in the second half.
Yeah.
But that's a huge motivator for me to even allow some self-compassion in there.
And
just having that written out, that the steps. I want to stick that on my fridge.
Good.
Yeah, and actually, there's several times throughout this today where I've thought, okay, I have to go back and just write out a few of the points that you had been saying, so that I can stick them in certain rooms where I tend to get triggered because it's a certain time of day, like in the evening when I'm dealing, or like brushing teeth or bath time, or because I know that when I'm in that mind state, I am. It's a totally different chemical makeup. Like I'm in that fight or flight. I'm angry,
and
they do seem like they're out to get me, which I know right now I sound so ridiculous, but when I'm triggered, it's not the same. Like I'm in it. So I think I wish I could remember to give you specific feedback right now, but there were several times tonight where you did say a few things where I need to go back and write them out. Yeah, so thank you.
Good. Thank you, Teresa, for sharing that. I appreciate it. I also realized that I had I wanted to read this little success story from Judy, who sent this in a week or so ago. The course is already making a difference in our household. I'm learning so much about how my reactions feed my kids' reactions. My kids are 13 and 11, and her 13-year-old jumped into the car after school the other day and told me that she had failed her math test. I was able to react with compassion and empathy and see things from her perspective. We talked about what could be done. This is problem solving and not directing. We talked about what could be done, and she expressed that she wants to go to Kumon to get help on her math, something Judy has been suggesting for months, but now her daughter will do it as it's her idea, is what Judy said here. And she said, I don't think we could have had such a productive conversation before your course. So that was a pretty simple place, but in order for Judy to stay detached and not react to her daughter failing the math test, that's exactly what I'm talking about. Being able, the failure on her math test was her daughter's problem. And because she could hold that boundary, she was then able, they were both then able to problem solve. All right.